Welcome to the podcast, recorded today, 20th of March, on the day we saw a 95% eclipse of the sun, a sign of the eclipse of the neo-liberal Tories, Liberal Democrats and Labour Party in Scotland come May. I hear the eclipse was not so spectacular in England. I hope the two aren't really related. Anyway, coming up, we've got Alan Grogan, co-founder of Labour for Independence and now in the SSP, talking about how the SNP Majority Council through in Dundee is now letting down the majority working class Yes voters through there. Ron Mackay on the increasing danger of nuclear war. Callum Martin on how Scottish politics were changed by the French Revolution. Ben Irvine on splitting the Yes vote. And Holly Cameron on how social media and the mainstream media may be putting off powerful political women's voices from coming to the fore. We have music from Scottish bands The Cundies and Button Up, and also a rare find from Leadbelly. The Cundies are a band hailing from the streets of Dundee and bring a totally unique, fresh and exciting sound to the world music scene. The words are unashamedly performed in the raw Dundee dialect and combine punching guitars, pounding drums and occasional bagpipes to produce a sound free from the shackles of genre, though I would describe them as the essential working class voice of the East. This is Fight Back.
For them who I choose to shout the silence, raise the fist and prank defiance. For them who I choose to fight back. Shovel shit. They think I should be happy, cause I'm gainfully employed. They think my mind deserves, and it's there to be destroyed. Well, you better think again, I'm not here to kiss your ass. You'll never break my spirit, cause my spirit's working class. The class we broke traditions, where the workers fought the rights. Boys like Harvey Murdoch, well, they're brave and gallant fight. To the suffragettes, to the miners, brothers, sisters, hand in hand. You're the same shit every day, 21st century. Progression and depression, it's like 1930. We're going back no forward, to the dark days once again. Slave-driven dictators, lashing people's brains. Modern day chain gangs, a kind of system lean. But then they're hoping to have that, they'll tell you what that means. That's what we are, it's what will I would be. Fighting for the workers' rights, solidarity. Working class, that's what we are, it's what will I would be. Fighting for the workers' rights, solidarity. Stop watching your master. Fucking bastard, drumbeats ramming speed. It's like galling up us pester. Then I think hurry up or wine, or scratch your ass next time. Just keep your head goose, sweat like hell, and keep your cell in line. For the warning signs are ominous, the fuse was burning down. Never just accept and let them wind round when I enter the ground. Cross no one make a stand, never mind a threat of sack. Taboo keeping your dignity, showing them we fight back. Working class, that's what we are, it's what will I would be. Fighting for the workers' rights, solidarity. Working class, that's what we are, it's what will I would be. Fighting for the workers' rights, solidarity.
Education is the very fabric of our society. As a socialist, education defines the lasting impact that the state can play in our daily lives. Through each passing generation, there has been an understanding that our legacy is to ensure that future generations receive greater opportunities than those afforded to us. Yet more and more education is becoming an accessible option for savage cuts by this Westminster government, tearing at the very heart of our ethos. For the first generation in a very long time, we can no longer promise our children better than what we had. Since the economic downturn of 2007 and 8, there's been a Western capitalist agenda to use this as an opportunity to tear down the social structures which have provided health, safety and a future for the many rather than the few. This austerityville we find ourselves in puts greater pressure on surviving services, especially in welfare, health and education. Following the last general election, we had to endure the stench of betrayal and hypocrisy as a generation of politicians who coasted through university life with loans and grants on their way up the slippery pole, telling us and telling this generation that their education wasn't economically viable. That if this generation wanted to advance in life, they would have to pay for it themselves, as well as paying for their taxes in the future. For those of us not fortunate enough to have an SSP candidate standing in our district, the choice at the upcoming election for those who believe that education should be made free to all at every stage of education is sparse. It's difficult to find a UK-wide political party which does not wish to continue with these savage cuts and education tariffs, which only succeed in creating further class division, hitting the poorest the hardest. The Labour Party have pledged to reduce tuition fees in England and Wales to £6,000, stating that any further reduction would not be fiscally viable. It's quite incredible that these politicians can utter these words, then use the same mouth to argue for a renewal of an out-of-touch nuclear arsenal that has no place in a civilised, modern society. Thankfully in Scotland, the Scottish Government has long abolished such draconian measures of charging students to learn. I'm no supporter, as many of you know, of the Scottish National Party, despite working with them in the referendum for Scottish independence. Yet this policy has always been something that I've greatly admired them for. This is why I've been greatly saddened in the forced closures of schools by the SNP-led council in my hometown of Dundee. Despite the SNP claiming to be an anti-austerity party at this general election, their own council majority in Dundee are enforcing a £7 million cut this year in which they are cutting vital public services. One of these is the intended closure of Meanishill High School, in spite of public protest. The plan is to merge them with Harris Academy some 2 miles away. The high school in Meanishill is an important part of the community, not only as a school, but providing after-school facilities, including swimming lessons. Many of the parents and carers who use these facilities, as well as those who have children attending school, are not in a position to travel further afield. Council authorities have blamed the smaller roll call, just under 500, at Meanishill High School, and have made the case that a larger curriculum can be offered by merging the schools. But this flies in the face of the intrinsic values of local schools as part of a wider community. I campaigned in Meanishill during the referendum and met lots of people who were voting yes. This area of Dundee has been abandoned by governments and local authorities so that now the poverty rate in the area is one of the highest in Dundee, with local food banks providing emergency food at ever-increasing numbers. The council should be looking to reinvest in the region, to create new jobs, to develop community and increasing the roll call of the school, rather than make it more difficult to ensure the young of the area are reaching school and thriving. Instead of this, these youngsters risk becoming more disaffected with their education and community, while their families have to sustain punitive costs for transport and new uniforms. These yes voters are now feeling abandoned and betrayed just as much by the SNP as they are by the Labour Party. Benjamin Franklin once said, "An investment in knowledge pays the best interest." We have known for a while that the Westminster elite prefer the bank interest to the interests of the people. It is now becoming apparent that the SNP are no better at local level, preferring to maintain their hospitality budget of £44,000 than fight to retain public services, smacks of the same self-serving nature the SNP have been quick to accuse the main UK parties of. However, they're not solely implicit in this. There has been no fight from the Labour councillors, including Dundee East Westminster candidate Leslie Brennan. It must be said that this is just the beginning. With other catchment areas now about to be reviewed, anything under a 4 mile journey is now being seen as acceptable for community school closures. Thankfully, members of the Scottish Socialist Party and Greens have joined with local residents and parish to continue to resist the closures as they seek a moratorium on the decision. We have shown the effect of people power in the referendum, and it will be the people who are the only hope for Munis Hill High School and the local community. A famous author once said that change is the end result of all true learning. Sandra Webster spoke recently on this podcast about the successful campaign to keep the children's ward open at the Royal Alexandra Hospital. It certainly wasn't Douglas Alexander who kept it open. This is where the real power lies. We saw it in the referendum, and we need to maintain this in this campaign. The campaign to keep Munis Hill High School open, that's the one that gives us real hope for change. For those comrades in Renfrewshire, Glasgow South West, Glasgow East and Edinburgh South, you have the fortune to have a candidate who represents your needs and aspiration. For the rest of us, we must continue the struggle in our own way. I, along with many other people around Scotland, will be going to these four constituencies and helping campaign to ensure that we have a Scottish Socialist Party representation at Westminster, to ensure that the people have representation. Our fight, locally, nationally and internationally, won't be represented by the Tories, not by Labour or the Lib Dems or even the SNP. It will be done by the people, supported by the party that is there for the working class of Scotland. And that's the Scottish Socialist Party.
Thanks, Alan. Button Up are a band from Scotland playing a blend of the Northern Soul Hammond Maud sound. This is their new single, Not Interested, available on iTunes, and it comes from their latest album, Beat Street.
Scottish politics are more prominent and more powerful than ever. But if the last week has shown anything, it's that the double standard that women are held to, particularly in the media, is not going away, and in fact it's intensifying. Whether that be due to political tension or because of exposure through social media. We've seen both the First Minister and the leader of the Conservative Party, Ruth Davidson, come under some brutal attacks from the mainstream media and from so-called cybernats on Twitter. These attacks are particularly disgraceful because It's not particularly about the women's political style or even the action that they've taken. It's reducing them to sexual objects and their gender in a way that is insulting and degrading, to say the least. With regards to recent political cartoons portraying the First Minister, it has long been a tradition in political journalism that cartoons are a way of expressing one's opinions with humour, which is perfectly fine. I believe in freedom of speech, as I'm sure do all of you. But the particular difficulty comes when women are depicted, as I say, as basically just as objects reduced to their sexual parts, which we saw with the cartoon drawing of the First Minister on Tuesday. If you hadn't seen that, it was a play on Ed Miliband being in Salmon's pocket, but this was a cartoon drawing of Ed Miliband between the First Minister's breasts, which sexualised her in a way that was not needed and wouldn't have happened to any man, in my opinion. The attacks on Ruth Davidson take on multiple levels of discrimination, given that it was an attack on her as a woman and as a lesbian. The comments that were made about her, I won't even lower myself to describe or repeat them, but it was aimed at the fact that she was a lesbian, implying that her sexuality was not a legitimate part of herself that was not up for discussion or debate, in a sense, just seeing her as being somebody. That typical argument, woman who's miserable, any sort of strong woman finds herself hit with that attack of, oh, you just need a good man, you just need a good shag, which is the sort of attack that Ruth Davidson found herself under, being an openly lesbian woman in a public space, which is just an absolute disgrace, to say the least. I don't think it is an understatement for me to have said that women are more powerful and more prominent than they ever were before in Scottish politics, and I think that that's a really positive thing. The thing that particularly concerns me, and I know concerns women who are in Scottish politics, is looking at the atmosphere around these prominent women now and worrying that young women are not going to want to go into representative politics because of the unhealthy, toxic air around them. I've not mentioned Kezia Dugdale yet, but she, of course, leads Scottish Labour in Holyrood at the moment, given that Jim Murphy was elected leader and he doesn't have the seat in Parliament. But that's another discussion for another time. She is frequently called Dougface on social media. That's one of the more popular nicknames, which again just reduces her to her physical appearance and doesn't particularly note her politics or her conduct, which is a particularly vicious form of attack. The worry is that young women will feel that this scrutiny is not worth being put through for being able to be proud that you are a woman politician, that you're representing the people who have elected you, and that you're working to make Scotland a better place. What we need to remember is that, you know, we have seen a major increase in women who are activists through the referendum, and I would be absolutely delighted to see these women progressing through political participation and into Parliament. I think that women can make a really positive contribution to society if there were greater proportions of them in the Parliament, and if they were well equipped and well supported to be the best politicians they can be, which they might not be at the moment. Well, I say might, they just aren't. They're being reduced by the media to sexual objects, which, you know, we need to find a positive and active way of tackling.
Thanks, Holly. This is Joe Solo with a song written for the Hatfield miners and their families who endured so much standing up to Thatcher in 1984-85. This is The Long March Back.
When I march beneath that banner, it's with a sense of pride. My brothers and my sisters marching right here at my side. We're marching for the past, yeah, but it's for the future too. They came for us, will come for you. When I march beneath that banner, I know where I belong. Swift them is always at my back, and struggle for so long to save our jobs, our homes, our families. Tell me, what else could we do? They came for us, they'll come for you. So I'm singing, flying a banner high, flying a banner high. They can take away our trade, but not the stand we made. So come on, fly a banner. I learned some good things though, I know beyond a doubt. If everybody pulls together, no one goes without. I know a little goes a long, long way, and used as good as new. They came for us, they'll come for you. So I'm singing, flying a banner high, flying a banner high. They can take away our trade, but not the stand we made. So come on, fly the banner. Beneath that banner is with a sense of pride. Do we never bust the piddling scabbing for the other side? I know when fate it came a calling, we stood loyal, strong and true. They came for us, they'll come for you. To get singing, flying a banner high, flying a banner high. They can take away our trade, but not the stand we made. So come on, fly the banner high. Take away our tread, but not the stand away all made. So come on, fly the banner.
There are a few people I can say are truly inspirational individuals. One of those people, Ron Mackay, is in my branch, in the Kempsey branch of the SSP. Ron has been on the right side, fighting for socialism and peace for most of his 91 years. The music after he speaks is from one of his favourite composers.
In 1942, when I just started my second year of a science course at Glasgow University, I was called up. I joined the Royal Navy. I was trained to service the then secret weapon radar. I was sent to India where I remained until 1945. On the 6th of August 1945, I was in Madras, southern India, for VE Day celebrations. In spite of the horror of Hiroshima, like some of the other service personnel, I thought that the enormous destructive power of nuclear weapons would make big wars impossible in the future. Clement Attlee, apparently, thought that too, but the US President Harry Truman persuaded Attlee that banning the bomb, which at that time only the US possessed, was not best policy. 50 years ago, General Eisenhower warned of the threat to peace of the military-industrial complex. The military-industrial complex nowadays dominates the United States. I'm a long-time member of CND. I've protested at Aldermaston, Dunoon and Faslane many times. I'm very worried at international developments. Russia has nuclear weapons, they're all in Russia. China has nuclear weapons, they're all in China. The US has nuclear weapons, but they're in Germany, Poland, Turkey and bases around Russia. NATO is an aggressive military-armed alliance under US control. Professor Tyler, a US economist, says we need a big war to settle the economy. A number of voices in America have expressed this opinion. John Tolger reports the US Congress Resolution 758 in a nutshell says, let's get ready for war with Russia. Amazon recently displayed a book, Winter Kill, The War with China Has Already Begun. There have been already two world wars essentially caused by economic problems. Are we to have a third? We are 30 miles here from the nuclear arms dump. The position is very serious. The planet is in its most dangerous situation ever. The present generation has the power to improve life on the planet or to destroy all life on the planet. Many eminent individuals are warning that the situation is extremely serious. Noam Chomsky, John Tolger, Michael Chudovsky, Richard Sackbaugh, Helen Caldicott, and many others have voiced their concern. We've had two world wars caused essentially by economic problems. The big capitalist powers have serious economic problems. Has there to be a third world war? The signs are ominous. The Westminster warmongers are spending billions of pounds, not just on Trident and other nuclear weapons, but on huge military projects. The US policy of perpetual war, which our defence so-called experts slavishly follow, throws a heavy burden on welfare state. Warfare and welfare are incompatible. The media plays a significant part in promoting war propaganda. It is a powerful opponent of the peace forces. We badly need a strong, active socialist peace movement which can accommodate the socialists in the Labour Party, in the SNP, in the Greens, the SSP, the Communist Party, and other socialists, some of whom are in no political party. We have much in common, not just peace, but anti-Trident, anti-austerity, green issues, etc. This need is urgent and vital. This matter should be raised at every meeting held as we approach the elections. As John Tolger says, our responsibility is clear. Expose and identify the reckless lies of the warmongers and never collude with them. He also says, all three liberal newspapers have misrepresented the events in the Ukraine as a malign act by Russia, when in fact the fascist-led coup in the Ukraine was the work of the United States. Russians are being portrayed as the bad guys and NATO as the good guys, when the reverse is probably more true. The prospect of a third world war is not a matter to be left in the hands of the academics and philosophers, but affects us all in our everyday life, our daily lives, and threatens the future of our children.
My name's Ben Irvin. I'm the convener for the Inverclyde branch of the Scottish Socialist Party. Now, I've often argued that the Westminster elections and the Holyrood elections ask different questions of the Scottish electorate. As far as the Westminster elections go, the most important questions facing a Scottish voter revolve around Scotland's status within the United Kingdom. Should we be independent? Should we have more powers? When it comes to Holyrood, the most important questions are what kind of Scotland do we want to live in? Some people have suggested that using this logic, all socialists should vote for the SNP rather than the SSP to protect the yes vote and further the cause of independence. Now, as everyone knows, our party, since our inception, have been committed to independence for Scotland. With the general election in May coming up so soon after the referendum, We'd hoped that all Yes parties would put up a united front and continue the campaign for independence. We were the first of the Yes parties to call for a Yes alliance to fight the upcoming election. Sadly, this was not accepted by either the Greens or the SNP, who decided to return to party politics rather sooner than most Indy supporters would have liked. Of course, it's their right to do so, and given that all of us on the Yes side have vastly larger memberships now than prior to the referendum, they probably feel confident that they can do rather well on their own. We're disappointed with our decision. We think that independence for Scotland is more important than party politics, but the SNP do not share that point of view, and so we move on in our own directions. When it became clear that the SNP leadership intended to put party politics before the independence movement, the Executive Committee of the Scottish Socialist Party agreed that in the absence of a Yes alliance, our party would also stand candidates. So does this create a dilemma for Scottish Socialists? I don't think it should. We should still vote SSP where we can. We have no obligation to the Nationalists. While I stand by my opening assertion that the constitutional issue is the most important one as far as Westminster goes, it's not the only one. Apart from independence, the politics offered by the SNP and New Labour are very similar. They both belong to a brand of capitalism that we stand against. The SNP might have some nice-looking social democratic-type policies, but they also have the economic policies of the right, where Scotland becomes nothing more than a source of cheap labour with which to lure the multinationals. The SNP stands for something much more appealing to the working class of Scotland. We stand for a Scotland where people come before profit. So arguably we're splitting the Yes vote and taking votes away from the SNP, thereby handing the victory to New Labour. That may be correct, but it's far from certain. We know from experience that a lot of old Labour voters, disgusted by that party's continued slide to the right and embrace of neoliberalism, are attracted to the SSP. But even if it is true that we are splitting the Yes vote, should that stop us from voting for SSP candidates? Absolutely not. The SNP have no God-given right to be the only independence-supporting party to stand for Westminster, despite what some of the lunatic fringe members of that party have been arguing. And remember, we offered the SNP an alliance. It was them who turned it down. If protecting the Yes vote was really so important to these people, they have to explain why they didn't take our offer when it was on the table. So I'm not concerned about the SNP losing seats because we split the Yes vote. After all, logically speaking, they are also splitting the Yes vote by standing, so fall foul of their own arguments against us.
Thanks, Ben. I collect vinyl and do the rounds of charity shops and second-hand record dealers. This week I found a brilliant album of music recorded during the 1940s by Leadbelly with Woody Guthrie, Cisco Houston, Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee. This was released as an album in 1962, though I know it has since been digitally remastered and re-released. This is We Shall Be Free, played on a crackly record player in the way that it should really be heard.
Sitting on a log, no use me working so hard. I've got a woman in the rich folks' yard. When they kill a chicken, sends me the feet. Thinks I'm working, I'm walking on the street. Happy that time.
We saw last week that the French Revolution was a key event in European history. It was, however, a key event not just for France, but for the entire European continent. Scotland, for example, was one of many countries which would in time begin to feel its shockwaves. I'm Callum Martin of Edinburgh South and Midlothian SSP, and welcome to Making the Flag Red, looking at the struggle for democracy for history. This week we're taking a look at the impact of the French Revolution on Scotland. Now, many historians are quick to paint the French Revolution as being a turning point in the political history of Scotland, portraying it as the moment in which Scotland began to see a revived and revitalised democratic movement. Now, whilst there is an element of truth in this, one should be careful not to understate the extent to which radical or reformative democratic and political ideas were already stirring beneath the surface long before events in France began. Movements to extend the vote and to restore the right of congregations within the Kirk of Scotland to choose their own ministers, a right revoked by Westminster after the Act of Union, were both strong in Scotland well before such events in France began. Now, what is certainly true, however, is that the outbreak of revolution in France gave a much-needed confidence boost to the egalitarian democratic movement in Scotland. Before the revolution, for example, we see only two, possibly three, confirmed and documented reform societies in Scotland, in Edinburgh, in Glasgow, and in Perth. After the revolution kicked off in France, however, the number of open, visible and active reform societies soars to anywhere between 80 and 100 across the length and breadth of Scotland. Now, the revolution also initially gave much hope and inspiration to elements within the Whig Party, then a dominant force in Scottish politics. The Whigs represented a political tradition born out of opposition to absolute monarchy and pushed for electoral reform and stood in opposition to the Tories at Westminster. Now, it may sound at first like these are the same people as the reformers, but there was a certain distinction to be found. For example, it soon became clear that events in France were moving rather faster than wealthier and more aristocratic elements within the Whig Party would have liked. The stalling of the Whigs' support for the revolution at this point in turn helped fuel the reform societies who began to push for more and more egalitarian advance. Liberty trees, for example, one of the symbols of revolution in France, reportedly began to appear across Scotland around 1792, giving concern to the establishment and hope to those pushing for reform. Now, after a time, many of these reform societies, having previously been involved with a group called the Friends of the People, would come to band together to form a group called the Society of United Scotsmen, a mass organisation looking to build an egalitarian Scottish Republic. Parallel societies of United Irishmen and United Englishmen also existed in this period. Now, for many, there was a respective hopes and fears of revolution breaking out in Scotland, and for a time it looked not impossible. How, though, do we account for not having been a revolution in Scotland? Perhaps the key turning point was when the terror began in Paris, as we discussed last week. That was really the point in which events began to swing backwards. Mass executions in France played badly with public opinion in Scotland. Many voluntary militia associations began to develop, and pressure for Scotland to have its own official, royally recognised militia began to resonate. The loyalists had retained a strong grip on establishment organs, such as the press. Reforming newspapers such as the Edinburgh Gazetteer simply did not have the same reach as the establishment newspapers. Now, whilst there was a widespread desire for reform, despite loyalist control of the press, a number of factors came into play around this stage to prevent that translating into a more wide-scale, overt agitation in Scotland. Firstly, many reformers in Scotland stuck closely to the view that constitutional and peaceful democratic reform was the only viable solution in the face of establishment opposition. Whilst on the other hand, a number of key influential figures did support more radical methods. The issue at stake, however, was those who supported these more radical and revolutionary methods, including a planned revolution and coup for Edinburgh in 1794, known as the Pike Plot. Many of the figures who supported these movements were very swiftly arrested and imprisoned, and on the pretext that they'd been planning revolution, other figures in turn were drawn in, dragged before Scottish courts and severely punished in great haste. Judges such as Lord Braxfield became incredibly feared across Scotland. They gained great infamy for their harsh and brutal treatment of reformers dragged before them. Now, such strict and severe responses served to convince many reformers to keep their head down and to turn away and back away from greater agitation. Many other radicals and reformers, meanwhile, such as Thomas Mew, were variously executed or transported to Australia, removing much of the potential leadership of the movement from Scotland. Mew in particular was viewed as a potential president of the Scottish Republic and a potential ally by revolutionaries in France. As we see, therefore, in the 1790s, the Scottish Republic was not to be. All in all, we can see a process by which existing reform movements in Scotland were given immense boosts by the French Revolution, spreading and re-radicalising the ideas they held before events and the establishment conspired to bring them to heel. Now, whilst many of these organisations were dispersed, and many of the individuals either transported or executed, the newfound strength of the ideas that they laid and spread continued, they survived, and would prove essential in helping to fuel the pressure for electoral reform, eventually released at various stages through the following decades and indeed through the 19th century, and gave a much-needed boost to the democratic movement in Scotland that could not be stopped by execution or transportation or deportation. Indeed, many of the reformers of the day are still celebrated today, Thomas Mew and Robert Burns both being deserving of segments of their own. And next week, that's exactly what we'll be looking at. Thomas Mew, Robert Burns, and the struggle in the 1790s for the cultural movement behind the Scottish Republic. Until then, though, I've been Callum Martin. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, Callum, and I look forward to the next episode. We finish with Dundee's finest, the Cundies and Scheme Life.
Your stories, this is just your street culture, telling language we can't order.